Okay, we are on the last class. The Reformation is over. And what we're going to be talking about is what happened. What actually happened in all this? And was there peace? And what's the aftermath? What came out of the Reformation? And so some of this is a lot of opinion of a lot of scholars who studied and everything else, but it's kind of interesting to go through all this. What happened out of this was something called the Peace of Westphalia, and that was the final peace treaty that was negotiated in all of this. And it actually was a series of peace treaties that were signed between May and October of 1648. So this is really we said the Reformation era ends in 1650. It really ended in 1648. They were signed in a number of cities that were in the general area called Westphalia. So that's why it's called the Westphalian Treaty, or Peace of Westphalia. But it was actually in more than one city because there were just too many people involved in all these negotiations. They went on for a very long time. And these treaties were designed to end the 30 Years' War, basically, but also to end all the religious wars of Europe. So the peace treaty talks about all those. Now, the Westphalian Treaty is an actual document. You can read it online if you want to go read it while reading. But it actually is really just a summary of all the other treaties because there were so many treaties going on across Europe at that time. And now if you look at the timelines here, I filled out the timeline chart so to show the war. Now, you can see why I've been saying all along that essentially the second half of the Reformation was just bloody. I mean, it was nothing but wars. And it was the French wars took about 36 years and finally got settled. The Dutch Revolt lasted about 80 years. And the 30 Years' War. And these two were basically settled on the same day in terms of this peace treaty. But and these were all very different. It was by far, this was the bloodiest war. And it happened all at the end. The French War was pretty bad. I'll talk about that in a second. And the Dutch Revolt, it's a little misleading to say it was an 80-year war. Most of the fighting stopped somewhere in here. And from then on, it was kind of a standoff between the Spanish and the Dutch Republic. And the Spanish kept saying, "You belong to us." And they said, "We don't either." And they didn't get along. And there were some minor skirmishes, but there was not major bloodshed in the last 30 or so years. But they finally did settle it in this peace treaty, and we'll talk about that. So this is what happened and what it all led to. Now, I'll say it again, this was not a treaty itself. It was a series of treaties signed between May and October of 1648, but it was finally put in one big document. But they literally spent 4 years with literally thousands of people involved traveling around negotiating all these things because every country had its own interest they wanted to protect and they wanted to be part of this. And what it effectively did, though, and it really did this, it ended the European wars of religion. There were no major religious wars after this. And it ended the 30 Years' War in the Holy Roman Empire and the 80 Years' War in the Dutch Republic. And in fact, in this treaty, Spain formally recognized the independence of the Dutch Republic. They said, we don't want it anymore. It's a country. And they essentially promised they would never try to invade it again. So a lot of things happened as a result of this. And all these various treaties actually are very important in European history because they established a framework that was used in diplomacy literally for the next three centuries. There's a lot of things came out of this that came out as a result, really as a result of these wars, that became standard practice in European diplomacy after this. Just one example is the notion of having a balance of power. You've heard the term balance of power in diplomacy. Well, there wasn't really a balance of power in Europe before this because the Holy Roman Empire was very strong, and the others were not nearly as strong at first. And one of the things they tried to write into the treaty was for everyone to recognize that we need a balance of power, then we won't have wars. And so it's become a diplomatic thing for literally for centuries after that. Of course, in the 20th century, that got blown apart. There's no such thing as a balance of power anymore. But there was for quite a while in Europe. And it was a standard way of thinking. Some other things about this peace, surprisingly, it did not involve any major territorial wins, losses, or gains. There were some minor ones, and I'll show you the map and what some of the minor ones were. But basically, the maps kind of looked the way they did before when it was all over. However, the power of some of these countries was dramatically different, and we'll talk about that. One of the things that came in this is that the Habsburgs acknowledged they would never again rule over a unified Germany. Now, you have to understand who the Habsburgs are. We've talked about it, but the Habsburgs was a major royal family in Europe. They controlled Spain. They were the king, queen of Spain were the Habsburgs. But also, the Holy Roman Empire was controlled by the emperor, who was a Habsburg. And Spain also controlled the southern part of Italy. So, the Habsburg family had a major control over Europe at that time. They had Spain, and they had the Holy Roman Empire, which was huge, and then they had the southern part of Italy. And when it came to Germany, they acknowledged in this treaty they were never again going to be the rulers over a unified Germany. And we'll talk about what they meant by that. And the Spanish, again the Habsburgs, conceded they would never again try to recapture the United Provinces. They gave up and said, we're not going to do it. Now, part of that was not that they turned good. They were broke, and they literally couldn't do much anymore. Quite importantly, though, the Catholics in Germany admitted that Protestantism was here to stay. It was written into the treaty. They said Calvinism was here to stay, not just Lutheranism, but for the first time, Calvinism was recognized as a religion. So some really important things got said in this treaty, and we'll talk a little more about that now. When I say Catholics in Germany said that, I'm talking about all the Catholic princes and dukes and guys who ran all the individual states in Germany. That doesn't mean the Catholic Church said this. The Catholic Church never admitted that Protestantism was here to stay. Now, we'll talk about that again in a minute, too, also. Now, let me talk again about the results of these wars. I talked about it last week, but it's good to remind ourselves really how horrific all this really was. The 30 Years' War in the German states, which was the very end, it happened rather suddenly right at the end of the Reformation. 8 million people died. And that was a 50% reduction in all the male population within all those German states. And it was worse than that. Okay, if you really read the details of what happened in this war, particularly after in the last part of the war when the Swedes came in and the French invaded too, those armies were just going back and forth over Germany, taking everything and killing people. There are lots of reports of cannibalism, things like that came out of this, because the people were starving. They destroyed everything. They destroyed the crops. They destroyed everything. So it was a really horrific thing. And all that really started sinking in on everyone right toward the end of the Reformation era. And it changed everyone's thinking about what should be done in the future. The French Wars, they had an estimated 3 million people died. And if you look at the Dutch Revolt, the estimated casualties there were high, but we actually have very little good numbers. People don't know how many. It's generally believed it was quite a bit less than these other two, simply because of the way that war was fought and the fact that there wasn't much of a war toward the end. Plus, before that, it was mostly sieges of cities. It wasn't open warfare on the plains like it was in Germany and France. So, but most scholars will tell you that in all these three wars, something in the range of 12 to 13 million people were killed, all over religious disagreements. Mostly, it started out as religious disagreements. A lot of it turned into quests for power by these various royal families, too. But all of this was so devastating that what tended to happen, a lot of conclusions were reached right toward the end as these treaties started to be negotiated. There were several things that a lot of people had already decided by this time. And some of them were kind of surprising, particularly based on what Christendom was like before that. One of the conclusions was we could never let religious leaders dominate the states anymore. We can't have popes and even Calvinist leaders telling us what to do. So there was an attempt in this thing to weaken the religious hold on secular governments. Second thing, we've got to reduce the power of the Habsburgs. Everyone thought they were a big part of the problem because they were very strong Catholics and very militaristic. Spain was always, you know, when Spain was rich, getting a lot of gold from the Americas, they spent it all on wars. And they were very militaristic. And they said, we've got to do something about that family. And that was a big thing. The third thing was, we've got to do something about the Holy Roman Empire. We cannot, this was the balance of power, really. We cannot have one large conglomeration of military power that's much larger than everyone else and more dangerous, therefore, than everyone else. And we have to do something about that. And they did something about it in this treaty. And we'll talk about what that was. Let me just briefly, let's look at a map. And the only point I want to make on the map is I did say that there were some territorial losses and gains. They're not too dramatic, but if you look up here at Sweden, these lands right here across from Sweden were taken over by Sweden as part of this. And this gave them control of the Baltic Sea, which was very important and something they wanted. And the Swedes, of all these, also got a large cash payment from the Holy Roman Empire. It's something they negotiated before they left the battlefield. So we're not leaving until you pay us back for a lot of this money we spent. And so they actually got a big cash payment out of this, too, so that the Swedes actually gained in international power as a result of this. And a lot of these other little colored areas are just areas that kind of switched allegiances as part of the treaty. Maybe they were Catholic before, and now they were Protestant. A lot of smaller things, but there were no major territorial gains. France was roughly the same size as before. The Holy Roman Empire was roughly the same size as before, but as you'll see, it's a very different empire as a result of this. Because one of the things that came out of this is they ruled that the Holy Roman Empire was not going to be ruled by the Holy Roman Emperor. It's going to be 200-something separate German states, and they're all independent. And that made all the difference, because the Holy Roman Emperor could not tell them what to do. And we'll talk about that. Now, I said before that the Catholic rulers of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire basically acknowledged that Protestantism was here to stay. And I said, now, that wasn't necessarily the Catholic view. So what did the Catholic Church view of this? After the Peace of Westphalia came out, Pope Innocent X issued a papal bull. And it was a very sharp bull. A papal bull is an announcement that carries the full weight of the Pope behind it. It says, this is what it, the way things are. And as a vicar of Christ, this is what Christ is saying. He said, the Peace of Westphalia is null, void, invalid, iniquitous, unjust, damnable, reprobate, inane, and empty of meaning and fact for all time. Now, other than that, he liked it. This actually represented a kind of a tipping point in Europe. For the first time, the Pope said something big like this, and everyone ignored him. They literally ignored him.
Did the Pope sign it?
The Pope signed it, but none of these Catholic states even agreed to sign it.
I mean, the Pope signed the Peace of Westphalia.
Oh, no, he didn't. There were some representatives of the church that were involved in the negotiations, but the Pope didn't sign off on this at all.
Did the Catholic princes?
Yeah, the Catholic princes, they signed off on this.
They were all independent.
Yeah, by then, this time, they are independent. As a result of this treaty, they're independent. And so the Catholic Church view never changed, really, at this time. And just kind of related to that, as a result of all this, you know, all these laws of heresy sort of went out the window for most of these places. But that doesn't mean that heretics were still completely off the hook, but because there were still some, and particularly in the, you know, some of the histories I've read in Spain and in southern Italy, there were some more executions against heretics even 100 years later. They continued. Spanish Inquisition actually kept going for a while, but at a very, very low level. For the most part, this thing really changed. And when I say it's a tipping point, from this point on, secular powers grew in importance and church power declined consistently.
So sounds like everybody else kind of came around the view of the Anabaptists. Did persecution of them start to slow down?
Well, they were still persecuted more than others. And in fact, even in the 17th, 18th century, they still felt persecuted enough that many of them left for America. This treaty did not give them a free. The treaty was very specific. Lutherans and Calvinists are okay.
Mike, could we say that the Treaty of Westphalia was the beginning of the idea of separation of church and state?
Yes. Very, very clearly at that point. From that point on, there was a general feeling that, I guess the way it was stated was, we cannot let religious leaders tell secular leaders what to do. We can't. Look what it got us into. The reaction was that strong. Now, what were the consequences of this peace agreement and everything? The first one I've already mentioned slightly. Germany got divided up into many, many territories, and it was over 200 of them, I think. All of them had what I will call de facto sovereignty. They were given the right to do what they wanted. Now, do what you wanted was not exactly religious freedom. What it really meant was, it was this concept that I think I mentioned before. It was part of an earlier treaty in which the term was cuius regio. I can't pronounce all the Latin, but what it says, he who rules, his is the religion. So in each of these regions, if you were a prince and you were a Catholic, you could say everyone in my little precinct or whatever it's called, the state, is Catholic. And the others could do the same thing, but you could not persecute non-Catholics in that state. But you could say, we're Catholic, or we're Calvinist, or we're Lutheran, whatever. So they were allowed to do that. So it was sort of de facto sovereignty. Now, what actually happened, a lot of these smaller states in Germany elected to stay with the Holy Roman Emperor. They were worried about some of these other German states around them might try to push them around, and they felt more safe in a larger organization. So the Holy Roman Empire actually went on for two more centuries. It just was not very powerful. And none of the people in it even had to do what the emperor said. So the power of the emperor just went completely away almost as a result of this. Now this obviously rearranged the power structure in Europe. The Holy Roman Empire was now pretty much defunct. It was there, but it was nothing to be feared.
Was there an emperor still?
Yes, there was an emperor still.
It
was a Habsburg, but he had no power. And that was the distinction. Spain was quite weakened as a result of all this. The Dutch Republic was now officially recognized. Spain said, you're okay, you're a country. We're not going to bother you anymore. I didn't mention it here, but Switzerland was officially recognized as a separate from the Holy Roman Empire. They had been acting that way for six decades, and the Holy Roman Empire didn't want to invade them because of the mountains, but now they were officially recognized in this treaty as being a sovereign country and free of the Holy Roman Empire. What most historians say about all this is that two countries came out of this much stronger, France. France was now recognized as the strongest country in Europe because they had some of the smallest losses and they'd had time to recover from their wars. Primarily the reason they were now the strongest is that Germany suddenly was one of the weakest. Germany never did, for about two and a half centuries, never got reorganized again. Germany didn't get reunified for a long time after this. Sweden became very strong as a result of this. there was a substantial decline in the power and influence of the Catholic Church and of Protestantism over secular governments. Secular governments began to recognize that they had to stand up for themselves and not let religious leaders tell them what they had to do. And this went on essentially for a long time after that. This was also, as a result of all this, the beginnings of true religious pluralism. Calvinism was officially recognized as a religion in the empire. It was on paper now. Before that, Lutheranism had sort of been blessed but in the Peace of Augsburg, but not totally. But now both Lutheranism and Calvinism, but those were the only two mentions. As I mentioned, the Anabaptists didn't get a free ride out of this yet. So this was, again, some of the consequences. Yeah. There were more. There was a dramatic weakening of the Habsburg dynasty. All of this was not a result of this treaty. Part of it was the fact that Spain once again had gone broke. I think I mentioned during the Dutch revolt, yeah, Spain three times had to declare bankruptcy because it just ran out of cash. Mm-hmm. And they were still weak. But now they were admitted in this treaty that they were not going to fight anymore. And you have to recognize that what Spain had been doing was they were trying to carry on wars in Europe and against the Dutch revolt, and they were fighting the Turks in the Ottoman Empire because the Ottoman Empire was threatening southern Italy, which belonged to Spain. So they were spread out all over the place, and they just pretty much acknowledged that they were not going to do that anymore. And as a result of this treaty, they gave up the Holy Roman Empire, really, because the emperor no longer had any sway in the Holy Roman Empire. So they were dramatically weakened, which is what they wanted to do. They wanted to weaken that family. There was a rise of the Bourbon family in France. Remember, if you remember the Bourbons, they were the Calvinists who fought against the Guise family. But they became an important dynasty going forward. Not that France immediately switched over to Calvinism, don't get me wrong. It was strongly Catholic for a long time, particularly in the rural areas. But the Bourbon dynasty started taking over the royal family. There was a rise of the Swedish Empire, which before was not considered to be a strong country, but after this was considered to be very strong, because they almost single-handedly whipped the Catholics in the Holy Roman and the 30 Years' War. And when they came in, everything changed. It's partly because of the brutal way that they fought. They did it. And another consequence was the decline of feudalism pretty dramatically. Now, you can't blame, or you can't assign all this to this treaty, because feudalism was already starting to weaken a great deal, but it started downhill even further after this. And again, part of this was just due to the tremendous loss of life. So the feudal system wasn't working very well when there wasn't enough workers. Other consequences. The war's last years revealed the ascendancy of a secular political interest over religious motives. And what I mean by this is, during that part of the war, if you remember, just as Germany was starting to weaken, Cardinal Richelieu over in France convinced Louis XIII, the King of France, let's help these Swedes. So this was a Catholic cardinal and a Catholic king giving a whole lot of money to the Swedes to help them beat the Catholic Germans. So this was clearly a case, religion wasn't in control. They wanted to weaken Germany. This was a political one.
I'm wondering, as we've studied this whole thing, it just feels like at some point, and it may be halfway when all the war started, this stopped really being about Christianity, and it became about political power and control.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's any question about that. It became that, particularly when the French got involved, but even the Swedes. They were Lutheran, and they wanted to stop these Catholics, but the King Adolphus of Sweden wanted to assert himself, too. And I think he hoped to gain a lot of territory out of this. He didn't, but he gained a lot, though. He gained some of what he wanted, which was control of the Baltic Sea. So there was a lot of family and political things going on. Each of these royal families were trying to exert control over each other, too. more and more, this extending the trend of increasing state control of churches, rulers in all these places tended to start to subjugate religious concerns to the state's interests. Religion became secondary in most of these countries. And this was a dramatic change in a place that for centuries had had this concept called Christendom, in which the church and the secular interests, the magistrates, were running things together all the time. And this all started going away fairly quickly. And as I indicated before, Pope Innocent, the denunciation of the Peace of Westphalia was politely ignored by everyone. This was a signal event to everyone. The Pope's losing his power, and everyone knew it. I don't think anyone attacked what he said. On this thing.
So,
no, I don't want to get these. Okay.
Oh, you're saying.
And so the Pope's influence went down and never really recovered from all this. And the last thing is, the Holy Roman Empire was never again an important entity, not for 3 centuries at least. Germany didn't reunify for a long, long time, as you're told. So a lot of things they tried to accomplish, they actually accomplished with a lot of the things. But it would never have happened, I don't think, if these wars hadn't been so brutal. The shock of these wars, particularly the 30 Years' War, was just overwhelming to people. And they said, we've got to do things differently from there.
Mike,
can
I ask you, back on that list, you said that the state control of the churches in Europe, the state has, we have the state church of various countries, like the Lutheran Church has been the state church of Germany and with the Scandinavia. Is that when this actually occurred, or?
Well, it started occurring then, but already, one of the things we didn't cover in this whole presentation was what was going on in England. In England, the king was the head of the church. He just took it over. He said, the Pope is not running my church, and that was it. And this happened during all this time frame. So that was happening a little bit everywhere. And
I know some of the countries have let go of the churches, the control of the churches. Mm-hmm. But I know, in Norway, the state paid for the pastor's salary and the upkeep of the church, and people gave donations to the church. They went to foreign missions, pretty much, or other things. But I know Norway's backed off from that. I don't know about Germany and
well, someone who knows more about Germany than I do may correct me on this, but I have heard from friends of mine who were stationed in Germany for a while that German citizens pay a tax.
Yes, they have for a long time. Norway has kind of backed off from that. I don't know 100% of what, but
if it's changed, it's been in the last 15 years. The thing that surprises me, and I've been thinking about for the last week or two or three, when you have a weakened Germany, I mean really weakened, and the other countries around them, and you now have the state in control as opposed to religion, it's interesting to see how several hundred years later that the Holocaust, which was able to take over Germany, and how passive the people were. And you'd think that if they lost 8 million people, that they wouldn't want to cause any war again.
Well, when I said earlier that the balance of power idea was blown out of the water in the 20th century, Hitler was one of those who helped blow it out of the water.
Right.
Well, I can say during when Hitler took over, didn't he put like 600,000 Germans out of Russian camps? I mean, he imprisoned all his opposition, not all the Jews. There is like 600,000 or 700,000 people put in prison.
6 million losses.
I mean, there are 6 million Jews killed, but he also put his own people. He put his opposition parties in jail. There was no rebellion because they're all in jail.
There's actually a famous speech that Hitler gave when he was at the top of his power, when he was pounding the table and said, "We have finally stop this stupid idea of a balance of power that came out of Westphalia. He was attacking it. That was a dumb idea.
Hitler, when he came, actually started thinking about racial superiority in Mein Kampf, had an example that he used to justify his values. It is the American example of what we did to the Indians. And we were a superior race, and had a right to deal with the Indians to essentially commit genocide on the Indians. And Hitler said, we have a racial right to commit genocide on people who are less than us. And that wasn't only Jews, it was Serbs,
Gypsies,
the handicapped, the mentally ill. And all told, the Nazis killed 12 million, 6 million Jews, 6 million others.
I say, Hitler, you model his massacres after the Turks. What was it he said? Who cries for the Armenians? Who remembers the Armenians?
Yeah.
They were starving, according to my grandfather.
Me too. Well, of course, in the 20th century, we have to acknowledge that the balance of power no longer exists because there's one, still one superpower, and it's the United States. It's dramatic. If you've never looked at the numbers, the military budget of the United States compared to any other country,
as much as the next seven.
Yeah, the next seven easily. And I'm amused at the fear of Putin, but the military budget of Russia is like 8% of the U.S. military budget. It's ridiculous on them. And if you look at the number of foreign military bases, I mean, one of the ways strategically that people look at who's trying to dominate the world is how many foreign bases they have, not military bases, but foreign bases. And if you take... There are many, many, many countries in the world that have no foreign military bases. But if you look across Europe, UK, Germany, France, and Russia, in total, have about 20. The United States has like 180. So it's we're the power in the world now, using those kind of metrics. So there's no such thing as a balance of power anymore. It's kind of gone out the wayside.
Anyway. Much as well on this, but I was thinking a while ago, brought up, also we've been talking about the Reformation, there's been no mention of the Jews. Did they just sort of separate from this?
Well, the Jews were heavily persecuted still during that time, and there were a lot of the Reformation leaders who were not very kind to the Jews, particularly Martin Luther. He wrote some really vitriolic stuff against the Jews.
He did.
But no, we didn't cover that here. One of the things, if we'd have been able to spend more time on the Low Countries, is that that became a haven for Jews after a while.
Mm-hmm.
They welcomed Jews back into the Low Countries in the northern. I'm talking about the northern part of the Low Countries, the Republic. Okay. Now. So that was kind of the aftermath of that treaty. What was some of the aftermaths of the Reformation era itself? And I want to mention a few of them. The Reformation did have some long-term effects on a lot of elements of modern society today, including marriage, women, the family, religious art, religious architecture, literacy, education. A lot of things changed as a result. And I think it's kind of good to remind ourselves of what some of those things are. There were profound changes in the cultural concepts of marriage, women, and family life, away from the old Catholic idea of marriage and family life. The Protestant reformers, if you remember, they rejected clerical celibacy. They said it's totally unnecessary because they had this idea of the priesthood of all believers. Everyone is equally holy if they work at it, and you're not holy just because you're celibate and a priest. And so they rejected celibacy, and they emphasized the importance of marriage, which the Catholic Church never actually did. And But they, at the same time, they said it's non-sacramental. The Catholic Church said it's a sacrament. You have to do the sacrament of marriage when you get married. The Protestants threw that out, but they said that marriage is important, and they stressed the mutual obligations and responsibilities that members of the family had to help each other, much more so than the Catholics did. The Catholics responded to that, though, during the Reformation, particularly in the Council of Trent. Well, let me, one more point about the Protestants. By eliminating celibacy and monasticism both, the Protestants exalted marriage as superior to celibacy. They said it's the only legitimate calling for men and women. That was a thing that a lot of the Protestants wrote about. And then the Catholics responded to that in the Council of Trent and said, oh no, as usual, you're wrong. And they affirmed the superiority of celibacy to marriage. Marriage was neither the only legitimate, nor was it the highest calling for men and women. The highest calling was to be a priest, to be a clerical person. And celibacy was a sign of that. So the Catholics never backed off from that during this entire Reformation era. And really for a long time after that. I noticed that the current Pope made a little comment a few weeks ago that maybe he might consider doing away with celibacy. I don't know why he said that, but he's got them stirred up. Okay, so there were changes that resulted from the Reformation. Another area was religious art as adultery. A significant change here. You remember the Reformed Protestant tradition, and that included Zwingli and Calvin. By Reformed, I mean the Calvinists and Black Calvinists. Not necessarily the Lutherans. I'll talk about them in a moment. But Zwingli and Calvin and others, they completely rejected religious images as idols, and they had to be eliminated from any role in Christian worship. But the Catholic Church came back and said, no, Baroque art and architecture will continue to flourish in our religion, and they're used for teaching and devotional purposes. So images are not idols, they're means of instruction, inspiration, and devotion. So they took a strong view that nothing's going to change. Interestingly, the Lutherans had a little different view. The Lutheran attitude toward religious art was kind of cautious, I would say, rather than being hostile. And they allowed a continuation of certain forms of art within their churches. And Martin Luther himself never did regard religious images as inherently idolatrous, so he didn't understand why Calvin and these others thought this way. So the Lutherans didn't quite totally go along with this, but they did tone things down quite a bit in terms of. And the other group, the Anabaptists, shared a very negative view of religious images, just like the Calvinists did. So they ruled them out. Whenever Reformed Protestantism was adopted anywhere, either when they built a new church or when they converted the Catholic Church, all the walls, everything was taken off. The stained glass windows were removed, and the walls were whitewashed. It had to be totally white. And all the focus in the design of the structure was from the pulpit, right in the middle, everyone faced the front, and the communion table. Nothing else was there. That was the design of all the churches in those days. And the whole idea was, we don't want people turning and looking at all the stuff on the walls. We want to focus on the Word of God. That's it. So it was a very austere view of churches in those days, in the way everything was done. So religious art as idolatry was a strong component that came out of this Reformation era. Another thing was literacy that changed as a result of the Reformation. Now, part of this, literacy had already started to pick up. As a result of printing technology, as a result of the Renaissance humanism and the Christian humanism, and growing demand just in the general economy for educated professionals, literacy and schooling were already starting to rise in a few decades before the Reformation was started. But the Protestants got it moving more. Both the Protestant and eventually the Catholic Reformation started to promote basic literacy, to improve religious knowledge, moral behavior, and started advancing education to provide competent ministers and priests. And so this was one that, although the Catholic Church never acknowledged the Protestants, they pretty well started agreeing with them. The Council of Trent was a major step forward in that Councilor Trent, they spent a lot of time talking about the fact that we as Catholics need to start educating our people. And it started then. And in both Lutheran and Reformed, meaning Calvinist regions, a large number of schools were established, and they started teaching basic reading, academies and universities, training ministers. And there was extensive Catholic education efforts that spanned elementary education all the way through university teaching. We talked about the Jesuits. That was their calling in life. They operated hundreds of colleges throughout Europe and Spanish and Portuguese colonies in the next couple of centuries. And it became a big thing. Literacy started growing dramatically. Interestingly, as a result of all this, the Catholic Church, while they were pushing literacy, were constantly, they stressed that literacy was for devotional reading, not direct reading of Scripture. They did not want their people to try to interpret Scripture. That was the church's responsibility. But you can read for devotional purposes and read the Psalms, read things like that. But that not to try to interpret anything. So they kept that focus all the time during all this time. But they did push literacy a lot.
But did they not push parochial schools also?
Yeah.
To the exclusion of other education, pre college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and both, frankly, both the Catholics and the Protestants became sort of champions of better education. And that definitely was something that came out of the Reformation. So it's kind of time to ask the question, was the Reformation a success? As usual, in such a complex question.
I have one question. We talk about celibacy, and from what I've read, the popes on down with the priests, they were all hypocrites when it came to celibacy. They all kept their mistresses. And that's what I've read.
That even came up in the Council of Trent. They tried to address those kind of reforms. They knew that a lot of priests were cheating on the side. Mm-hmm. They knew. And they tried to address that. It was a problem. Okay. When you ask a question like this, the answer is always, well, it depends. Who are you talking to? Who's making the judgment? Also, what region are you talking about? And what time span are you talking about?
But I didn't know the Reformation had they had set out a list of goals at the beginning that they wanted to accomplish that you could check off at the end.
In fact, I'm going to cover that in a minute. They did. Well, the things that they thought were going to happen. But in one sense, the Reformations were a reigning success if your criteria is the modern world. If you judge by modern criteria, where we've now achieved, quote, religious freedom in the West, and diversity of religions, and everyone's free to practice, and a lot of people in the modern world value that a great deal, then you can say a lot of this came out of the Reformation, and the rise of individual freedom of conscience and worship. So, and I've seen this in a lot of writings currently by Protestants and others, particularly Protestants, saying the Reformation was a success. It gave us religious freedom. It's built into our Constitution. We love it. But if you view it back in the 16th century, Christendom as a whole, and the unity of Christian doctrine and practice, the Reformations have to be seen as a huge failure, because there was no uniformity anymore. Broke everyone apart, and they started squabbling. And all the religious leaders of that era sought for a very rigorous Christian and unified in doctrine and worship. None of them got what they wanted. None of them. And the fact that they're now called the Reformations rather than one single Reformations is kind of an indication of that lack of success. And geographically, if you move across Europe, things were very different in different places. The reforms that were attempted by both Protestant and Catholic were much more successful in the cities where there was some education, but were almost no progress at all for a couple of centuries in some places, and the larger uneducated populations. This literally didn't take over instantly. It took a long time for more and more people to understand. And so most of the reforms that did happen tended to happen, the literacy and everything else, people understanding their religion better, happened in the cities, and did not happen in the rural areas. And the rural areas was 90% of the population. So it took a long time for a lot of this to take hold. And interestingly, the Protestant, from the Protestants, we have a lot of information on that. Once they started going out and trying to teach in the rural areas, they would hold classes and trying to teach them about their religion. They went back later with visitations and asked people, tell us about your religion. And they found that even after decades of this kind of education they were trying, large numbers of rural men and women had no idea what their faith was about. They couldn't answer any questions at all. So it was not an instant success. And part of it was people still couldn't read and were uneducated. So it took a long time. And Protestantism had actually more of a problem than the Catholic Church in this, because in Protestantism there was a big emphasis on the words of Scripture, and word and preaching, and printed pamphlets and so forth, and verbally based worship, which the Catholics didn't have. They had a lot of sacraments and things they practiced, but did not have that much preaching, and in fact, very little preaching. In a preliterate society, it didn't work very well for the Protestants. What the Catholic leaders did was they sought to reform and kind of redirect what they were doing in terms of their traditional liturgy and piety, rather than to try to uproot it altogether. And they actually were a little more successful in changing things, but not a lot more successful. And in still in many remote rural areas of Catholic Europe, which was southern Italy and large areas of France, that all the missionary efforts that they had trying to educate the people had little effect deep into the 17th and part of the 18th century. They saw no improvement at all. So it was a success slowly in a lot of this thing. Now, ironically, the Anabaptists were more successful in all these reform efforts, but that was due to the self-selective nature of Anabaptism. You weren't really an Anabaptist until you knew everything and could be baptized as an adult. I mean, you were taught everything first. So if you were an Anabaptist, you were already literate, sorry, pretty close to it, and you knew your religion very well. Now, but that success of Anabaptism didn't cause Anabaptism to grow any, because that was coupled with this big restriction that they were separatists. They did not want to live with the evil world. They were always off by themselves. So they were more successful in reforming some of their in improving their literacy and other things, but it didn't result in a large growth of Anabaptism, because they just refused to join the rest of the world, basically. Now, there were some religious shifts that went on as a result. One was, during the Reformation era, the average man or woman definitely experienced a shift from Christianity as primarily something that you practice to Christianity as fundamentally a body of doctrines you start to believe. Of course, that shift was happening mostly among Protestants, but somewhat among Catholics. And Catholics began to recognize that understanding your doctrine was important. They just didn't know how to get there quickly. But even in Catholicism, as part of the Council of Trent, this mere implicit faith became less acceptable. And the Council of Trent stated that. If you remember what implicit faith means, in the Catholic teaching for centuries, there is explicit faith and implicit faith. Explicit faith was something that was available to the educated people. They could read the Bible, they could understand, they could be taught doctrine and what to think. But 90% of the people couldn't do that. And for them, implicit faith was available. And implicit faith means you still don't understand anything about the doctrine, but you do what the church tells you to do. You do the right number of sacraments, you go to the right number of masses, you go on pilgrimage, you buy some indulgences every once in a while. And if you did all that, you could be saved. But the Catholics, even as early as the Council of Trent, which was right in the middle of the Reformation era, started to recognize, and a lot of their bishops and everything started to really tell the Pope, this implicit faith idea is not really a good idea. We need to do something about this. We need to educate people. So that became, and you never hear Catholics talk about implicit faith anymore. It's gone by the wayside now.
Kind of
a difference between education and indoctrination.
Yeah.
I think there are still a lot of people who are faithful to the Roman Catholic Church that are functional on implicit faith.
Yeah.
They went to catechism when they were kids, and that's it. They don't need to know anymore.
Well, Judy and I had some Catholic neighbors when we lived up in Pennsylvania who were people we love very dearly. But they like to come over and talk to us about their religion, and we would talk to them about ours. And they were very conservative Catholics. And one of the things they talked to us about, they became very upset that their daughter had gone off to college. And she had joined a group of people who were studying the Bible, reading it. She said, they're actually forcing her to read the Bible. And they were upset about this. They said, she shouldn't be doing that. And they were very good in their faith. I
mean, we had a neighbor who was married a Catholic and was never spoken to by her family again. And my father was a Catholic and married a Protestant, and they agreed that I would be raised as whatever, non-Catholic. And the nuns came to the house and instructed them, 18-year-old parents, that this baby was in hell, and there's no hope unless you raise a Catholic. So it's still very, very.
Now, in addition, all these doctrinal disputes where the Protestants were arguing with the Catholics about what is the correct way to interpret Scripture actually resulted in a much more emphasis on the importance of right doctrine. And the Catholic Church got involved in that over time. They started, and one of the things that came out of the Council of Trent was a rigorous rethinking of all their doctrines to make sure that they were right. And some of them they changed, but not many of them. And there was a shift, although this was a smaller subset of the religious communities. There was a growth during this time after the Reformation of more emphasis on self-conscious individual spirituality. There were more people getting involved in certain types of the deep prayer and going off themselves to get closer to God because they just didn't trust the church anymore. And this became a growing thing over time. But it was always small. It was always a small number. But and there were a lot of even Protestants at this time who kind of wished. I said, why did we get rid of monasteries? And, you know, we need people who are doing that kind of deep prayer and stuff. But this actually grew as a result of the Reformation, more people getting involved in a more mystical, you might say, approach to spirituality. But it's good to talk about, since we're doing this, what were the foundational shared beliefs that all Catholics and all Protestants still held, no matter what, things they agreed on. Protestants and Anabaptists and Catholics all believe the Bible was the Word of God in a very strong, incontrovertible sense. No question about it. It's the Word of God. No one disagreed on it. They all agree that God disposed of events according to His will through His providence. God was in control of things. They all agreed on that. They also agreed they're going to be rewarded with either eternal salvation or condemned to eternal damnation. This was really important stuff for them. And only through God's definitive self-revelation and incarnation in Jesus had salvation become possible. They all agreed on that. They were never fighting about that. And one can only be saved through the proper adherence to God's teachings and the correct following of Christ. They all agreed on that. And this is where the problem came in. What is the correct teaching? And so when these doctrinal disputes came up, it caused a huge amount of tension. Therefore, the nature of the disputed issues meant that they were inherently explosive and divisive because they touched very fundamental questions, truth, meaning, our destiny, purpose. It was all important. So they went to war. And it was very important then because they believed all this so strongly at the time. All of them. And it's kind of interesting. Comes out that way. A couple of quick slides on ironies that came out of this. In many ways, the expectations of the future of Protestants, Anabaptists, and Roman Catholics were profoundly wrong. Catholic authorities mistakenly thought early on the game that 16th century Protestantism would be successfully controlled. They said, it'll be controlled under our legal system. They're all heretics, and we're going to get them. And they quit worrying about it. That didn't last very long, and it didn't work. Protestants, under radical Protestants, initially in the Reformation, wrongly expected that the Roman Catholic Church would soon collapse because they had such better ideas, and that there'd be a new church emerge. That didn't happen either. And the result of disagreements about the content of Christian truth yielded multiple Christian churches, something that no early modern Christians wanted or approved of. Virtually all of the early Christians believed, following some of the quotations from Paul, there's only one body of Christian faithful, therefore there's only one church, and all of that was destroyed by the Reformation. It didn't happen. So there was a lot of ironic things. A couple of others, religious intolerance contributed to the rise of a strong secular political order, which didn't exist before. And these recurrent controversies and recurrent religious wars helped make non-religious principles become the only reliable source for a stable society. So everyone came to realize if we want to live under peace of some kind, we can't do it with church leaders leading. That's a strong statement, but that's what they come down to. And modern freedom of religion would have been deplored by almost all the Christians in the Reformation era. They did not believe in freedom of religion. The only ones close to that were the Anabaptists, because to them, freedom from religion means they could continue to worship all by themselves without being persecuted. That kind of freedom of religion, they were in favor of. And the prioritization of religious concerns above all else helped to undermine concern for religion, clearly, as part of all this. And the religious conflicts of the Reformation proved vulnerable later to attack by secular ideologies as the Enlightenment came along and others and started attacking religion. They often attacked it based on these wars. They pointed and said, this is what you get when you follow religion instead of our ideology. So it became a negative thing, a positive in the future. So that's kind of a wrap-up. You have any questions about all of this?
Perfectly clear.
I mean, the religious rewards have returned. We're losing.
Yeah.
And it's being fought over various beliefs, and some people are dogmatic. One religion is not defending itself, offering no reasons.
Well, you know, if you look at the numbers, you could say, well, religion is still thriving. And the issue is, it's been pushed out to the margins.
But it's also still a cost of. There's a big cost of residents worldwide, but the religion right now. It's not Christianity.
Let's talk quickly about what's coming up next, because we're through with this part now. Sandy Kress is returning next week, and we're going to. This is a thing that the class voted for, wanting to do, and I have to remind you what it's about. It's the counting of the Omer. And when we looked at the mitzvot, when we got one of the mitzvot, one of the commandments of God to the Israelites was came out of Leviticus. It says you must count off 7 weeks, starting with the day after the Sabbath, the day you bring the bundle of offerings. You will count off 50 days until the seventh Sabbath, and then you must present a new grain offering to the Lord. This has become a time of celebration in the Jewish faith. They count the Omer, and it's an annual spiritual journey that they take each year on the 49 days between Passover and Shabbat. Passover, you know, Shabbat is the day they were given the Torah on Mount Sinai. So to Jews, that's their movement from total enslavement to complete freedom. And so an omer is a unit of measure. An omer of grain, an omer of barley was often brought to the temple as an offering. So they had these offerings. And they celebrate this every year to remind Jews of the linkage between the Passover, which commemorates the Exodus, and Shavuot, which commemorates the giving of the Torah. And it's to remind them that the redemption from slavery in Egypt was not complete until the Torah was received. So they celebrate this by actually counting their blessings. And Sandy had suggested that as Christians, we might want to consider this, and this is why we ended up voting on this, to have a similar celebration for essentially the same time frame, the 4 to 7 week time frame for us, between Easter Sunday and Pentecost. It's also 7 weeks. and we can go through this celebration and do the kind of thing that they tend to do. But it's a new thing. He's developed a whole new course based on this. Now, due to the complexity of our schedule, we can't start exactly on Easter. We're going to start just a couple of weeks, 3 weeks before Easter, so we'll be in roughly the same time frame. We're going to go through 7 weeks of this little celebration. And we've been on nothing but sort of history and doctrine for a while. This is going to be a spiritual and ethical investigation. It's the way this thing works. And it's patterned after some of the mystical traditions within Judaism, but the way it's often described is with this mitzvah of counting the 49 days, the Torah invites us to a journey into the human psyche, into the soul. There are seven basic emotions that make up the spectrum of human experience, according to some of these mystical traditions in Judaism. And the root of them all is enslavement. It's a distortion of all these emotions. So in these 7 weeks, we're going to examine and try to refine those emotions that we have. And these are the seven emotional attributes that they work on: loving kindness, discipline, compassion, endurance, humility, bonding, and leadership. And what Sandy has proposed we're going to do is we're not going to do one each day the way they try to do. We're going to do 7 weeks on Sundays only. So each Sunday we're going to cover each one of these. And what he's proposing is, and he's going to lead this, he's already put together kind of a course on it where we're going to study the mitzvah, study the Torah and read into it. So week one is going to be loving kindness. And we're going to do seven things with it in that first week. We're going to look at the loving kindness of loving kindness. Then we're going to look at the discipline of loving kindness. Then the compassion of loving kindness, the endurance, the humility, the bonding, and the leadership. Then in the second week, we're going to look at discipline itself. We're going to look at the loving kindness of discipline, the compassion of discipline, and we're going to work our way through all of these. And he's going to have Bible verses we're going to read, and we're going to talk about them. So how can we apply this in our life? So it's kind of a spiritual journey that they go on, and he's going to try to make it one for Christians.
Should we bring our Bibles?
Probably wouldn't hurt. I don't know yet if he's going to provide us with verses ahead of time or what. He did say he's going to provide me with something every week that I can send out in an email and put on the website so you can look at ahead of time and be prepared for it. But probably wouldn't be a bad idea. So that's going to start next week. We'll have 2 weeks of that. Then we're going to take a break for Easter. And then after that, Sandy comes back for 5 more weeks of that. So we'll do 7 weeks of this spiritual journey.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
One of your charts today.